Gwe, Nindeluisin Sosun Bernard. I'm from Mi'kma'ki and currently living in the territory of Unimagi. I co-host this podcast with my Mi'kichu Serena.
Nindeluisin Serena Liyawiyas Bukto, Nangiwu Susanato, Nekwetai, Ami Wadam Nandesit, Tandesit, Nomomir, Miskamich, grateful to have this opportunity to sit with Gaji and with you. I've really enjoyed the conversation that we've had so far, and I'm really looking forward to how this goes. Olario.
Welcome to Strength from Stardust, the podcast where we talk to fellow Indigenous people about Indigenous cosmology and the connections we have to the stars. Strength from Stardust comes from the belief and idea that we all come from stars. From a science point of view, this is true. We humans have DNA that comes from space, as do the plants and animals around us. We are all connected, and we get strength from that connection. This episode, we'll be talking to Gudgie Cook. Gudgie Cook, Wolf Clan, is a member of the Mohawk Nation at Akwesasne. Gudgie is an elder Indigenous midwife, a founding member of the National Aboriginal Council of Midwives. In her current work, Gudgie is Executive Director of the Spirit-Aligned Leadership, the intergenerational Indigenous women's sisterhood that facilitates the sharing of cultural knowledge between Indigenous women's elders and younger Indigenous women to ensure that Indigenous healing power, knowledge, and traditions are shared across generations. Now, before we get started, Gudgie, I'd like to give you a chance to introduce yourself the way you like to be introduced.
Yawa, Susan. Sego sewa gwego. Dagachi jakwa ni I yungyats. Akwesasrono, yewilogwas, wagatahuni, wagatsanuni. Hello everyone, I'm Gudgie Cook. I'm speaking to you from Akwesasne, which lies along the St. Lawrence River at the intersection of southwestern Quebec, southeastern Ontario, and northern New York State, where I was born, raised, and reside. I'm a grandmother of 12 and a mother of 6 with my life partner, Dr. Jose Barrero. I'm happy to be visiting with you this morning about Strength from Stardust at the invitation of Susan and her Mi'kichu Serena Francis, who are celebrated members of Spirit Align's Third Circle of Legacy Partners. I'll share with you a few Mohawk language concepts, symbols, and images to illustrate my stories. So thank you, Susan and Serena, for this invitation to visit with you on your podcast.
Thank you, Gudgie. So I see that you've done a lot of incredible work related to Indigenous women's empowerment and women's health rights. How did this journey start?
It starts at the beginning with the story of my grandmother and her mom in their farmhouse here at Akwesasne, carrying the practice of midwifery. I was delivered at home by my paternal grandmother, Elizabeth Gunatdilis Hearn Cook, who in her generation took care of many of the women in this community. Because my mother was ill with heart disease from the results of a childhood accident, she was told never to have children. Her uncle was the first Mohawk doctor at Ganawage. And but out of love for my father, who was here from Akwesasne, they had 4 of us, and I was born at home, delivered by my grandmother. And I grew up with the stories of how at that time, about an hour after my birth, I was bleeding from the cord stump. So my grandmother used her common sense. She took a needle and thread and sewed up my belly button. And as I grew up in her care, my cousins would tease me, "You better not make grandma mad. She's going to take her thread back." And I used to sit on my little cot next to her big white iron bed where I was born
after my bath, and I would search as an 8 or 9 year old for that thread that she left in me. And I realized as I grew into a young woman and participated in our women's dance, in our longhouse, all of our different ceremonies, all the beautiful teachings about Mother Earth and Grandmother Moon. My grandmother would describe that relationship as I reached puberty. She said, "Your Grandmother Moon is going to visit you now." They didn't use Latin words like menses or prepubescent. They used real talk. And my mother described how there would a nest in my body where the baby would grow. And so I needed to keep myself clean. And so you grow up in that world of attention to women and women's bodies and the power of women's bodies. And my grandmother was certainly a wonderful example of service to our community. She delivered many babies here at home when there was really no access to hospitals. Cornwall was a long way to go because there was no bridge at that time. And my auntie, who had many babies, she had 9 children that my grandmother delivered at home, including 2 sets of twins. Mm. And so these were courageous, magnificent elders I grew up with, self-sufficient, knew how to take care of business. Many other birth stories of my cousins that I heard that really inspired me. And just the way the women in my family were as kinship, sisterhood kind of relations, taking care of one another. I recall being 15 years old in our longhouse and asking my clan mothers, how do we teach the young about birth? I was so young already thinking about that kind of idea. And they said, you have to go to the story of the first birth. And that story is a star story that I'll talk about later. But to the question, how did I get interested in the path I took? I believe, and I know from my experience as a midwife, that we are all in this world for a purpose. As your Mikaju will say, we all have our gifts. And she's right. I like how one elder medicine society member here in Akwesasne said once in a ceremony, we're bundled in the sky world. And when the water breaks before labor begins, all those energies, all of that bundling from the sky world falls to the earth along with the ruptured membranes. And so all of that knowledge has to be remembered through the development of one's life, that you have to actively seek your purpose. And so that's the beauty of many of our ceremonies, is they connect you to true relationship with the natural world. The women's dance, for example, you shuffle with your feet on the earth and remind the women, we're just like her. We have the same duties, responsibilities to feed our people, to house, and even the laws. We have a concept of mother law here at Akwesasne, as articulated by Bear Clan Mother Wagela Gatste, who was one of the first circle of legacy leaders. And it has to do with matriarchal consciousness. It has to do with the matrifocal elements of our kinship structure. The men follow the woman to her home because that's where safety should be from the old longhouses. It was all based on the maternal clan. And so that matrilineal aspect of the mitochondrial DNA being passed from grandmother down through the granddaughters, generations, through the woman, that happens. They learn this doing the Human Genome Project, because the male DNA, even though it's just as important, it is responsible for our general characteristics and character and personality, all of that jumbles together from two bundles of genetic material, knowledge, you could say, in each one of us. But the male DNA or the male doesn't last. So you're not going to be digging up bones from 1,000 years ago and finding the provenance of that genetic line through the male DNA, but through the mitochondrial DNA, which maintains its stability through time. And so the focus of our cultures on the sacredness of the woman and the waters that she carries, I think that's the philosophy behind my interest in becoming what in Mohawk, the word midwife, of course, is an English-German word meaning with woman, which is a wonderful description of that kind of work. But the Mohawk word has been variously transcribed as she's pulling the baby out of the water, out of the earth, or a dark, wet place. You see a broader ecological context in that description of the woman standing beside the mother through a course of her care. Delivering the baby, of course, water's always involved. And it's just the natural direction, a natural source of expression, of kinship love, of you want your sisters, you want your cousins, you want your daughters to bring all the beauty, the symbols, the language. In fact, most of the people who have had their babies at home in my care, would first thing they would say after I would ask them, why do you want to have a baby at home? And they said, because we want the first words they hear, the baby hears, to be in our language, our Ganyangeha language. And in fact, we do have a tradition of speeches to the baby. And part of my work as Yewe Lokwas is to pay attention when people are using their language and to find out what that expression is really sharing. So when you go into birth and midwifery and women's health, there's a whole body of knowledge within that, because you're not dealing with just the individual woman, but the larger social and cultural body of where she's situated. And so bringing the resource from all of those elements, whether they be our own medicine plants, our own specialists, you could say, the dream interpretation, the dream material the mother carries. And if I were to characterize the difference between my course of care and a course of care from someone trained as a nurse midwife working in a hospital, not to say that that's not needed. Don't ever think that that's not necessary. But I would ask in my course of care and prenatal care, what are you dreaming? And often women will say they'll dream the baby. In the very beginning, around conception, they know it's a girl, they know it's a boy, they've seen the baby in their dream. Not everybody, but when you ask the question, what are your dreams? Have you had any dreams? And even when the woman would say, oh, I never dream, which to me is a marker of trauma. But when you go deeper into her story, you end up in worlds that are so fascinating, so awesome, so necessary, to like a lock and a key to open something, to help her open, to allow the baby to come into the world. And so, you know, we hear the word, we hear the phrase hold space. And really that's what the practice of midwifery is, to hold space, not only for the woman and her connections, her relatives, the ones who are going to support the life of a child, a new child. But also to stand in a body of knowledge that needs a bridge from my grandmother's generation to my generation to the new generations. And that's the magnificence in my mind of the Indigenous midwives in Canada. We're growing in number. We introduce ourselves as elder midwives because we're holding space so that our children, our relatives can see that my grandmother, my great-grandmother, all our great-grandmothers still live in this space of care for our own women, our own girls. Who's going to initiate those girls when they come into puberty? So we've reconstructed the puberty rites here at Akwesasne based on the regeneration of the corn, a core symbol of Mohawk tradition, the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash. We're all aware of those relationships that nourish one another. Women have evolved for connection. We tend and befriend, and that's the way we're hardwired. And so midwifery and the knowledge from the culture and from the sciences of it integrated are a powerful transformative space for individual Indigenous women and their families. And the story of the baby that's born lives in the dreams of the mother and then the interpretation of the birth itself. Thank you for your question.
Yeah, that was awesome. I remember my Mi'kmaq telling me that, like, when like people were born, so like me and I think like other like grandkids and stuff, there was Mi'kmaq, you may have to like jump in, but like I think someone always like yelling like, "Oh, Abidajich," or I forget what it is, but it's like you're yelling like, "Oh, it's a girl," or "Oh, it's a boy," type of thing. And that's like the first thing that was yelled.
Wow.
I spoke with Mi'kmaq first. Yeah. Words.
Wow.
What I am when you were describing the birth and taking from the earth. Mm-hmm. The baby coming from the earth. Mm-hmm. We have a Mi'kmaq word, which is Wajiskali, which means I sprung from the earth.
Oh, how precious. So
that image just came to me, and I said, there's a connection. And you always talk about, even though we may be from a different tribe, that we still have those connections that we share because of our respect and shareness with the earth. So thank you for that story, because it triggered in me something that's important.
Absolutely, Serena. Birth done under our own powers is regenerative of language. Imagine the word ecology, which really is the science of relationships, how things connect in a system. Birth, too, has a cultural ecology. And so one of the elements we know from linguistics that it's in the womb that the baby forms its linguistic patterns in its brain, that the language of the mother is the beginning of language education for the offspring. And how powerful that becomes in about the third trimester, where the traditional teaching is that all the experiences the mother's ever had, all the knowledge she carries, the baby learns that at that critical time in the last trimester. And so that's why some of the teachings had to be about being really careful how you treat a life giver, a water carrier, the pregnant woman. They would say, the elders, the old ladies, Don't stand in a doorway. If you're going to start an action, fulfill it. Don't go halfway and turn around and come back. Oh, I left my purse in the car. You know, to the point where one beloved elder, Alice Papineau, Dewa Santa from Onondaga, I was visiting her in her old-time house. They're not like the houses we have now. They were humble homes. She said, in my kitchen, there's windows. And when I was pregnant, I would stand at the window and look outside, looking at something. And my mother would come over and open the window and tell me, go out that window and go outside to look at what it is you want to see. Because again, this idea of the seeing, this way of knowing that is more prominent in some than others to the point where they are the designated seer. Think of it, the window that you can see through, the amniotic sac that's transparent, you can see through it, light penetrates it. This image of seeing. And so birth is implicated. It's an implicate space where language and attention to different forces at work, not just the musculature of the womb pushing the baby out, but of what's going on in nature. Where are we in relationship to a current of water, a river, a stream? In the old cultures, the old villages, they would always give birth by a body of water, because when you think about it, that current pulls and you already have a life encased in a body of water and you want that energy to support the birth. So a lot of old time stories of how our people gave birth happened along the waters. And it made sense. That's how you clean the baby after. And so when you describe your beautiful word for coming, springing from the earth, that thought doesn't occur to us until we're talking about birth. Or maybe it does in other contexts. But I've had so many revelations occur from, I remember one woman in a home birth, fluent Mohawk speaker, and her mom, who was an elder, was right by my shoulder when we were delivering that baby at home. And her mother started telling her in Mohawk something that in English, I'm telling her, don't push, you know, because this was her fifth baby and you don't want the baby coming out too fast. There are pressures on the skull when it's inside the birth canal that are released too quickly in an explosive delivery possible. So I was telling her, don't push. And her mother took her half a year to remember what it is her mother said in Mohawk. She said, I never heard my mother use those words before. And by the time she remembered, it meant push with your breath, which tells me that our Mohawk elders already knew the importance of using the diaphragm to push down against the top of the uterus, the top of the fundus where the baby is encased in the womb, to add supportive pressure to push the baby forward in the birth canal. And again, she said, I never heard my mother use those words before. Why? Because her mother hadn't been at a home birth since she delivered her own babies at home. Some of them hanging on to the knob in the kitchen and the doorway all by herself. There was, in many of our histories, there were no midwives to help. And women suffered because of it. And so I see what is called midwifery, indigenous midwifery, is an important element to restore to our communities, because not only it involves this two-eyed seeing that is a common theme in all of your work. The intuitive, the sacred, who's going to pay attention to that? Because that is going on big time at a birth. And it doesn't matter where that birth is occurring, hospital or home. And so the good news is that as we ramp up our capacity in our communities to restore our youth to their full identities. To me, that includes their birth story. You know, and there's some wonderful and really difficult birth stories. There's problems with births, but even those can yield amazing cultural knowledge. One elder I spoke to who's been gone a long time now, when I was young, because I always made a point to speak to the elder women about these things. And it's really hard because they're very modest, very shy. But as you speak to them, one said, well, I had a really dangerous delivery. I died in childbirth. She had hypertension and hemorrhaged. And she said, "In when I died," this would have been in the 40s, 50s. She said, "I went into the sky world and I walked in this room where there were 12 men fully dressed in traditional outfits and headgear. And they turned and looked at me and they said, 'You're not supposed to be here. But when you go back, we're going to give you the power to see, to interpret people's dreams.'" And so she woke up at the hospital and she survived childbirth and she hid from the public. But you know how we know things about each other. People would come to her for guidance and what ceremonies needed to be done with what was bothering them. And so when we talk about our community cultures, those are the elements that I find is where the two-eyed seeing is alive, where it lives, where knowledge is gained. But because we imbalance with just the other kinds of knowing, the way society is constructed, we lose this other part. And so I absolutely agree with you that when we talk about these sacred things, our words come back to us.
It's so interesting that how that story you were saying of that woman giving birth and her mother is like, "Push with your breath," but she said it in Mohawk. Like, yeah, like we knew these things a while ago, and it's people say like science is just like catching up now type of thing, where we had known it like a long time ago already. Yeah.
I put it this way. It's all in the practice. When I was a young woman wanting to become a midwife, you know, I got to the point where I learned physical assessment, interpretation of lab results, went to all kinds of women's health clinics and hospital clinics. And then I thought, where is the indigenous element? Because my clan mother said, "Oh, we forgot all of that." They didn't forget it. They just stopped doing it. And so I went from the University of New Mexico up to Pine Ridge to meet with who became one of the 13 indigenous grandmothers, Beatrice Holy Dance Long Visitor, who is my mother-in-law, because my brother, Tom, Ganadagoya de Cook, he married her daughter. And so in the Lakota ways, I'm a daughter-in-law, but my mother-in-law is my brother's wife's mother, who was a midwife at Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, fluent Lakota speaker, ceremonialist in several indigenous traditions, including the Peyote Way and the Sun Dance. And she told me, "You want to learn midwifery, you have to go in that teepee." And I balked at that. I said, that's not a medicine my people use. She said, "I don't think you know what this medicine is. It's a grandfather who will teach you. And you ask me to learn midwifery, and that's where you're going to learn it." So with my sister-in-law sitting right next to me, I sat up all night. And during the night, so much happened, so much What a beautiful ceremony with so much meaning. But about 3 a.m, when the main prayer was being made, I asked Grandfather Medicine, how will I know that I can support these two lives in a good, healthy, good way? And I don't know what I expected. The clouds are going to open. I'm inside of a teepee all night. And all of a sudden, me, who I have had hearing loss since I was a little girl from otitis media, my eardrums ruptured. So I don't hear well, but I heard very clear in my ear in that prayer, just do it. This was before the Nike commercial came on. And I left that teepee knowing we can be healed. And one of the ways that women heal, and one of the ways that young women wake up to themselves, is through having a baby. So when a young woman's pregnant, the job of the midwife is to open her mind, her body, and her spirit. And then in postpartum, to close all that back up again. But that's where transformation occurs. It's no longer just about her. And the ones that can't make that proper transformation, usually they've suffered some kind of trauma. And so you have to work with them through that. Get help on board if you can't manage it yourself. You know, Serena, I think your mom had something there. The first image that comes to mind with a pillow being thrown on the bed is the afterbirth, because it is the baby's pillow all those months. And it appears like a support. It is a supportive tissue. Those things having to do with afterbirth, you know, are part of those prenatal teachings. So it makes sense if you follow the image, you follow the symbol. In a dream interpretation, the images of the dream are the vocabulary of the individual's spirit. And a lot of that comes from the cultural space.
Mm. As you were speaking, my feathers started flying. But I literally flew.
Oh. Wow.
So cool.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Scary, but awesome.
But you know, see what we're capable of, even though it's all technology.
Mm.
It's again, the dream is pulled out of you from high emotional states, I've noticed. In dreams that really matter, dreams that I have, certainly, you wake up from a strong emotional state. And that's usually a marker that you've had a meaningful dream.
Mm. Yeah, that I remember hearing that the dreams, the dreams that you have will be like how you understand them. So like what one person's dream means wouldn't like really necessarily mean something to another person, and you get it like in your own like language and everything. But just because you mentioned that, that reminds me that I had this dream maybe like a month ago. It was like I was with a bunch of people that I knew in my dream life, but I didn't really know them. Like, I didn't really recognize them. And I was like leaving that space. So I was dying in that dream, and everyone around was, like giving me like a gift, like, something to put in this box so that I could have it for wherever I was going next. But I just remember like, being very emotional and upset that this was happening, and not because I was dying, but because I was dying really young, and because I hadn't been able to start a family yet in that dream. And I remember waking up and like crying like a lot. And that was like the first, I think the first time I've ever like woken up from a dream like that with like such a strong emotion. And yeah, I wasn't going to share that dream, but just because you had mentioned it and like the strong emotion.
Yeah. You recalled something that you're still carrying in your physical being. What time of night was it that you woke up? Was this a dream at 2 a.m. or you got up, went to the bathroom, came back to bed and had this dream?
It was like really late in the evening. So I had like, it was around like maybe like 3 or 4 a.m. And I remember it happening and waking up and crying. And like, I could see the, it was like starting to get a little bit light out, but it was still very dark out. And I just remember crying and then like going back to bed again. But yeah. And then like talking to my mom about it, like later on, like when I decided to get up for the day.
Okay, so if you were, say, a young pregnant woman in my care, I would have already said to you, if you have a strong dream, note the date, keep a journal by your bed. Because then we would look at what's the Mayan calendar day where you had this dream. And Roderico teaches that the strongest dreams are the dreams that one has just before dawn when you likely get up and go pee and then you come back to bed and you fall asleep again. And then you have this dream. But your dream was about 4 a.m. It was dark when you woke up. And reflecting on that, you are a 6 keme. Already you have to do with death. Your day has to do with acknowledgement of ancestors, that the ancestors can speak through you. But even that is, it requires a lot of ceremony. So when you described your dream, I thought right away, she's Keme. This is her part of her pattern in this world. The transformer. You're going from one state to another. This dream doesn't tell me that I have any concerns about your mortality. Your sentiment, your emotion around that you didn't have a family yet makes me think of recent concerns that you've had in relation to your Mikaju. That, of course, as someone who is a Keme, there are those emotions you're carrying that you might want to cleanse. But again, I'm just throwing out there, based on what I'm seeing from what you've described. And so a struggle within a dream is a necessary tension to get to the next place. One memorable dream by a woman in that was not quite in my care. She wanted me to go to the hospital with her because she was going to have a cesarean, a birth in the hospital after having had a cesarean. And she wanted to prevent having a second cesarean. So she asked me to go with her. And she was the kind of friend that I said, okay, I'll do that. But in her through her course of care, she said, I don't dream, you know, So we did a ceremony in her backyard, my husband and I, in her last trimester. Her baby was butt down, complicated by a breech presentation, which isn't good, especially when you've had a previous cesarean. So I sent her to a chiropractor to do a maneuver to help the baby turn at the last minute, which she did. And I went with her to the hospital. But before we had done all that, she said, I had a dream. I said, you did. She said, in the dream, I was heading into a forest. And you know how at the edge of the forest, there's brambles and berries and pickers. And then you get into the thickness of the darker forest. The trees are bigger. There's a pathway. She says, I was walking through this dark forest. And all of a sudden, I came at a space in the forest where there was a sunlight piercing through the canopy. And in the where that sunlight hit the earth was a a child. I said, how old? She said, about 18 months old. I said, what gender? She said, it was a girl. I said, there's your baby girl. What did you do next in the dream? She said, I went and got her, comforted her, took her hand and walked her out of the forest. So this is a dream I slip in my pocket to see if it's going to have any efficacy in helping this baby be born. Sure enough, we get to a very busy hospital. The OBs are all in the cesarean theater. The nurses are busy taking care of them. Good. I get left alone with this couple who are in labor. And she's hooked up to an IV pole. You know, the hospital is a hard place to give birth. They don't want her to get out of bed, but they're down the hall and I know better. So I took her into the bathroom with her husband, turned out the light, turned on the water, had her put her hands in the water. And when everything got calm, I said, do you remember that dream you had of that little girl? You're going to have to go this thicket through this dark forest and find her in that light. She said, oh, God, yeah, I can't do this. I said, talk nice to yourself. Tell yourself, I can do this. She said, this. Say it again, louder. I can do this. Mean it this time, louder. I can do this. And she did it. She came out of there and we got working and change, you know, you transform the energy. You shift it however you can. And a good dream gives her an embodied memory. She remembers in that dream how it felt. Yeah. And so what do we have here? I was thinking about this. We have a dark, wet place.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, somewhere familiar for the baby to come into the world.
The mother's working with water. She's not in an old village next to a current of stream, but she's in a hospital and there's running water, and water is medicine. Mm-hmm. And the darkness shuts off all the busyness. Down the hall, someone's having a cesarean. Over here, someone's in labor. You know, so much is going on in any hospital. So she gave birth to that baby vaginally, having had a previous cesarean section. Mm-hmm. And it just was a wonderful moment. But I share that to illustrate how the dream can be like a key and a lock to open the woman's spirit, open her body, and open her mind.
Nice. Yeah, so I know we'll be coming up on our time soon. Would you be able to share with us that star story that you were going to share with us?
Yes, and I hope we have enough time. It's going to take some minutes, but I'll jump right in. Maybe 5-10 minutes. Is that fine? Okay. This is a dream that I had on June 10th, 1984. When I woke up from this dream, it was a 9 kowok midwife's day, the completion of cycles. And I've written this long ago in 1984, this happened. In 1984, I had moved from the reserve to go to school at Cornell University to get a degree in biology and society. And women were still coming to our home to give birth in our house because I had moved off the reserve. And so where we lived, I called it my halfway house. It was an old farmhouse just above Cayuga Lake, above the town of Ithaca, New York. And it was a lovely bucolic setting above Cayuga Lake where there were huge cornfields as the slope of the earth goes down into Cayuga Lake, a long lake of the Finger Lakes. So this was about, what, 38 years ago? In a dream, I am sleeping beside my husband, Jose Barrero, in a treehouse nestled beneath a starlit sky. The great bulk of the stately weeping willow tree's roots driven firmly into the lush decidua of the earth below us. I am in the enchantment. Making her way up a ladder to our wooden platform, an elder woman calls out to me, "Gudgy, Gudgy, wake up. It's time for the sweat." Within the dream, I recognize her voice. She is one of the Longhouse Turtle Clan mothers whose family takes care of the sweat lodge ceremony in our community. Stirring in the warmth of my quilt cocoon, I answer her, "I'll be right there." Just a few more minutes of shut-eye, I think to myself, trying to pull out of the trough of a deep sleep. Then I'll get up and follow her to the lodge. It is one of those early morning sweats held in the zombie zone hours before dawn, a powerful time of prayer, fear, sacrifice, and connection. "Gudgy, wake up, they're calling you," my husband nudges me. "They want you to sweat." He won't let me sleep. Still within my dream, I awake and descend the ladder of our treehouse into the darkness of night. I walk into the big cornfield behind our home, overlooking the gently sloping shores of Cayuga Lake in the Finger Lakes region of New York State, ancient home of the Cayuga Nation. It is late spring, and the scent of damp, rich earth fills my nostrils. Tender shoots of maize, the corn from the new season planting, stick up out of the earth, standing like a line of sentinels guiding a path, guarding a path, following the contour of the land. Looking out over the gentle slope of the field as it yields to the shores of Cayuga Lake beyond, I see the silhouette of a sweat lodge, a great mound of darkness in the distance at one corner of the field. Three elder women are standing vigilantly to the left of the sweat lodge door. Dark shawls drawn over their heads cascade down their shoulders and back like husks covering long ears of maize, a drapery of sacred mystery, like the women of the Okiwe society, the ones who call to the spirits of the dead in devotion, memory, and prevention of illness. Their shadowy presence excites in my sleeping awareness a fleeting thrill of fear. Then instantly I am reassured by the presence of the morning star at the eastern horizon, its presence heralding the certainty of the sunrise to come. Like milkweed seeds bursting from their pod, the glittering light of the stars overhead explode against the mirror of the glassy surface of the lake below, reverberating a vast symphony of brilliant stars in the expanse of sky above me. Drawn in awe, I continue walking along the breadth of the field, feeling lighter and lighter, as though I have springs on the bottom of my feet with every step. Every springing step soon becomes a bounce. Every bounce providing greater buoyancy until I'm leaping, vaulting higher, higher into the womb of the sky with each step, making my ascent towards the twinkling stars. I observe them from a distance as they commence to rotate in synchrony, a sacred choreography of quickening, a dance of the stars. The stars gain momentum, swirling, twisting across the night in a brilliant weaving of forces that reveals the form of a great celestial turtle. Distinct head, tail, feet, and carapace emerge from the radiant chaos, a constellation of shimmering stars, a cosmic turtle made of light. The great turtle begins to twirl itself, swirling, spinning, and hurling across the sky, becoming footpaths made of stars without number. Starlight and stardust commence unfurling, becoming a continuous single line of animated celestial beings dancing across the sky towards me. Astonished, I witness light taking human form as it patterns itself into bodies of women who are dressed in the colorful traditional calico dress, skirt, and legging style of the contemporary Six Nations Iroquois longhouses. Weaving in unison like slender leaves of bean plants climbing way up a stalk of maize, the women reveal themselves singing and dancing the seed blessing songs. Beaded strawberry plants with their delicate red tendrils trail the edge of the women's skirts. Beaded white sky domes edge their velvet collars and complete the glistening raiment of the women. Dancing in turn towards them, I become aware of my own adornment. Looking down, I am astonished by this resplendent white deerskin dress with yellow, red, and blue rosettes at my bodice, waist, and hips. As the first three women of the endless line close in to greet me, I recognize them. They are women I have cared for in my midwifery practice who have come to show me their bright babies. The first woman I recognize as the mother of a young girl delivered on my own Julian calendar birth date several years before. An intuitive knowing vibrates the depth of my being. She's given birth again, I think to myself as I greet her. Her radiant newborn is held fast to cradle board with a beaded wrap adorned with brightly beaded hummingbirds, a symbol of the sweetness of life and of love. I greet a continuous line of longhouse mothers all over the sky world. They are standing, life itself standing, each mother happy, loved, and content as the baby in their arms. Suddenly, without warning, my dream is abrupted by the ringing of a telephone. I reach for the awareness of the breaking dawn back in my bed again in our home above the shores of Cayuga Lake. Jose sleeps soundly beside me. Although he is a light sleeper, he does not stir. The phone of my dream has ceased its incessant ringing, interrupted in my ethereal journey, ripe with connection. I feel both joy and an odd sense of loss. I drop my head back to my pillow, eyes closed, hoping to catch a breath, find a wind that will carry me back to that beautiful place. But I simply fall asleep again. Later, the morning comes. Jose awakens me, extending the phone to me with a concerned look on his face. A family member has called to tell me that sometime after midnight, a beloved cousin, a brother cousin, was in a car accident on a remote highway in California. He has succumbed from his injuries. After high school, he had been drafted into the Army. He returned to us after 2 years in Vietnam, wearing its traumas like a weight around his shoulders, its grief in his blood, and its wounds in his spirit. He had told me, when I got off the plane in San Francisco, I couldn't believe that the world acted like nothing was happening in Vietnam. Better to forget about all that had happened in a land far away, some would advise him. I decide to spend my morning basking in the generous sun of the backyard, overlooking the landscape of my dream, tender shoots of maize, gesturing from earth to sky, marking a tail in the universe, a trail in the universe, a threshold that leads to a world past the dark side of the moon beyond our vision. I am caught in the web of my dream and the slowly sinking reality of our family's tragic loss. I think of the site of my brother cousin's demise across the country, where already two brothers have flown to leap tobacco at the crash site, collect a bloodstained sneaker and sweaty t-shirt from the twist of car wreckage to complete the task of calling his spirit home and returning his remains to his family and homeland. When a loved one passes in such tragic circumstances, the abrupt severance of spirit from the body far from home disorients them, making their spirit journey of 10 days a difficult passage from the reality of a beating heart to the realm of an idea, a territory into which only memory can follow. The twin of birth is death. And so this story, this dream, occurred to me at a moment when something was dying, my brother cousin, and when babies were being introduced to the world. And I learned very early on in my grandmother's home that just a curtain away from the room where I was born in my grandmother's big white iron bed, my mother, who finally succumbed to her heart condition, was laid out in the sitting room. As a 12-year-old girl, I understood that those old men from Ganawage who sat up all night with her singing the dirges of the funeral songs, I learned then very young that birth and death are the same door. They're the same doorway. The 10 days attention to spirit. And so this is our reality here on earth. And that midwives work at both doors. And so the other interesting thing for me about this dream is it occurred at a time when New York State, Cornell University is in New York State, were closing, changing the laws so that lay midwives, unregistered midwives, could no longer practice. And I thought the door was shut to home birth practice and indigenous midwifery care. Not long after this dream, a doorway opened in Ontario with the 1992 Midwifery Act and Regulated Health Professions Act, in which I participated to operationalize the exemption, a formal legal exemption in the Midwifery Act of 1992 that exempted Aboriginal healers and midwives from any regulation by the government. So as one of 75 previously practicing midwives in Ontario and Quebec, I submitted charts to the Michener Institute and was selected as one of 75 previously practicing lay midwives who were being brought up to standards by the province, which means we were engaged with randomized control trials and research-based practices. I was an interim regulatory council member, a professional member of the interim regulatory council of the College of Midwives of Ontario, standing in that position to represent the Indigenous inside of the new regulations for how midwives would practice. I told my colleagues, if we don't use our rights, we'll lose our rights. And so used that exemption in partnership with the Six Nations Health Commission to establish Jihnue Unagarasta, Onagarasta, the place where they will be born, at Six Nations Ontario. And there, those midwives have continued all these years to build that practice. So you can see from those elements of the dream that indeed we do, all of it comes from this great cosmic house of relatives, the constellations that tell us when to do our ceremonies. Even in other traditions, there are astrological archetypes that inform who we are as characters, as personalities. But the indigenous models, such as the sacred Solkin, the Mayan ways of the days, are an authentic indigenous model and trained to corn gardens, to raising maize for one's life. And I like how Roderico would say, my mentor from that world, standing in a field of corn, what we know is a kernel on a cob of corn. And so inside of Indigenous knowledge, it's through just doing it, of showing up with the confidence, the competence, the skill sets to pivot, to move healing forward in our communities. And we do it through our dreams, our births, and our ceremonies as Indigenous women and girls. So thank you, Susan and Serena, for this opportunity to express myself and a little bit of my memories in my previous practice as an Indigenous midwife from Akwesasne, Daneto.
Thank you so much, Gaji. That was amazing. What a powerful dream. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us and, you know, let us ask you questions and have this conversation. I had a wonderful time, and yeah, I just wanted to say thank you so much. Walalan.
And I'd like to say that you filled my heart with joy. Oh. Your presence and your stories and your life has enriched mine. So Megad Walali.
Thank you for your kind words. I hope all goes well with you, and we look forward to the day when we can be together around a sacred fire and enjoy one another the way we're supposed to. I just wanted to reassure you that we're all feeling that way, that the face-to-face, being in a place together, is really where sisterhood is made possible. So on behalf of everyone at Spirit Aligned Leadership Sisterhood, I'm so grateful to you for your work as a legacy partnership. And I see such beautiful things in each of you and the work that you're doing. And with that, I'll say onegi wahe. Bye-bye.
Hi. Namotes.
Namotes. Bye.
Whoa.
Oh, that was so cool.
That was... I really like the analogy that she made, that it's the same door, whether it's birthing or whether it's dying.
Yeah, it makes me think of how, you know, like we have like the road of the spirits, like Skedegu Majauti, and that's where the spirit is, right? So it makes sense that that door of life would also be the door for death.
Yes. And that the concept of life springing from the earth is also true in Mi'kmaq too. And she shared that. And so when she was talking and telling the stories, because it rang in my heart, and she really did truly fill my heart with joy.
Right? Like, you know, I feel like I could talk to her for like forever and just like listen to her and ask her questions. Like, yeah, that was amazing.
Amazing for sure.
Yeah, so that's it for our episode with Gaji. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and thank you so much. Walalan.